Good evening, listeners and students of Hitler's Table Talk. Welcome to this week's program, which is episode 44. The date is January 29th, 2015. I'm Carolyn Yeager.
Turn right on.
So, right. Are we thank on? You very much. Yes, we're on. You're on too.
All right, great.
Oh, boy, I was just relaxing here. You know, I'm usually a little bit, I wouldn't say nervous, but up for things before a show. Then I don't forget things usually, but tonight I was thinking, oh, boy, it's nice. I'm just going to be relaxed. And so right away I forget to put your mic on. Oh, well. And you know, Ray, before we start tonight, I want to tell you and the listeners that I heard from our secret admirer again. I just got it today at the post office. The one who is so anonymous, I don't even know where he's from. But he sent another package with a newspaper in it, and he sent a beautiful message. And I just agree with every word in it. So, and I imagine you might agree, too. So I thought I'd read it tonight.
Wonderful. Yes, please.
Okay, and he says, "Hi, Carolyn. Thanks for reading my comments on your show, and I'm so glad you and Ray liked them. I'm happy to give another but smaller donation," which he did. Here's another old newspaper. This is from 1988, actually, showing why what you and Ray do is so important. The white race will never survive. The white race will never begin to live, or ever really live again, we could say, until the lies about Adolf Hitler and Germany and the filthy Jews that tell them are destroyed, and the truth about Adolf Hitler and Germany is not only acknowledged, not only faced, but finally and totally embraced. And then he adds, he puts at the end in very large letters like a slogan kind of, "Hitler was white and Hitler was right."
Wow. I like it.
Well, I agree with it because more and more, from the time that I first started getting into all of this, what, maybe 10 years ago, seriously, I've come more and more to agree with the idea and hold the idea that Adolf Hitler is the key to all of this. And the problem is that a whole lot of people amongst white people and European people don't agree with that or don't want to think that and are very resistant to it. But, they say, oh, we'd do better without him. I don't want to turn this into a show about this, but it does fit in with our show. So we'll do better without him because he's so unpopular and we can't overcome him. We'll never overcome that. So let's leave him behind. And it's not because I don't want to, but I think, oh, no. But I don't think it can ever possibly work if you do that. I agree with this man that the white race will never survive until we do this. And this is very divisive in what's called a movement. But anyway, the newspaper he sent me was from 1988. It was in the USA Today. It was a one-quarter page ad for a three-part television series coming up tonight, tomorrow, and Thursday, it says, on Hitler, the Nazi nightmare. And there's this close-up of his face and mustache, you know. It says, He cast a diabolical shadow on the world. For three nights, witness the power, the madness, the downfall. And then the first one is Raid on Rommel. Tomorrow is going to be Hitler, the last 10 days, and Thursday, Inside the Third Reich, all starting at 8 o'clock at Superstation TBS. Well, I don't know who this person is, but he's right on, he's right in tune with you and I, isn't he?
Yes, he really is. And, you know, Carolyn, unfortunately for us, what you're talking about there is a demonstration of the barriers that have been put up to truth since World War II to keep anybody from actually learning the truth, because the truth will destroy them and what they have done. And I think it's very important that we keep plugging away and doing what we can do. The old saying is that the pendulum on that clock does not swing the same direction all the time. And I'm I like to believe that when that pendulum starts to swing back our way, there is going to be vengeance, there's going to be retribution, and there is going to be joy when the forces of evil are knocked out of the way. And to hear from this fella that has written you, it's encouraging because it points to the fact, and those TV shows, they're rotten, they're just garbage. But the fact that they're produced gives you a good feeling, because what that says is they know that they have to be ever vigilant, ever active, promoting more and more lies, because their castle of sand cannot stand anything like your show and other people who are doing things to enlighten. So,
well, our show,
it's a compliment.
You mean this one.
Yeah. Well, all your other shows, too, they're directed in the right direction. But, and we've got a good show tonight. I really enjoyed reading our topics tonight, you know, about the Nuremberg rallies. And a very neglected part of history is what was going on in Spain regarding Franco and the control there. And then how important Egypt was in this whole thing. And then, of course, towards the end, if we get to it, the building of the autobahns in Germany and how fascinating that was. So we got a good lineup of topics tonight. If I might, I just want to say something about how you bring in your timelines, which are really, really nice and add to the show. As most folks know, and maybe some people listening here know, I taught American history on the college level for 6 years here, and the text that we had to use was typically what you would expect, and particularly regarding this era. But it gives timelines for each chapter, and I grabbed that textbook, and I looked at it a while ago, and it's chapter 27, World War II, and it says, Blunder or Decision in the National Interest. And it gives timelines from 1904 all the way up to 1945. And if I may, this won't take long, but this is some of the timeline stuff that is given to students in school. And, you know, we use this text from the time I started teaching there to the time I left. They're probably still using it, just updated versions of it. For 1941, your timeline said, Lend-Lease Act, Germany invades the Soviet Union, Roosevelt and Churchill issue the Atlantic Charter, Japan bombs Pearl, U.S. declares war on Japan, Germany and Italy declare war on the United States, the Manhattan Project begins, Hitler begins the extermination of the Jews. And then switches over to 1942, Roosevelt orders the War Department to confine Japanese Americans on the West Coast, the Battle of Midway checks the Japanese Pacific advance, which you've mentioned on a previous show, and the Women's Army and Navy Corps, the WACs and WAVES, were established. But you see, they got to put that in there. Hitler begins the extermination of the Jews. And you're talking 18, 19, 20-year-old students, you know, that are looking at this. And it's so discouraging. And, you know, when I was teaching, you know, as an instructor, I did my best to work around that without jeopardizing my job, but at the same time, letting these students know that, hey, something's not right here. So anyway, that's just these timelines in this textbook. And that's the system we're bucking, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, that's the same of the timelines that I'm using the one at Wikipedia because it's actually better than any others I've found. But it mentions it every time there's anything about the Jews, it mentions it, but I just don't bring that out anymore. I just skip that part because it's not even important.
Well, we're on the same page because I never once in my class when I taught that era, where I never once mentioned the Holocaust or the extermination of Jews. I did the whole thing about World War II without ever mentioning that.
Good for you.
And it was good because no student ever asked anything about it until I taught 6 years, and about the fourth or fifth year, one student held up their hand one day and said, Professor Goodwin, I've heard about there are people today that are denying that this Holocaust actually took place, and I saw something on television. They call them revisionist historians, and these people are saying this didn't really happen. Did you see that, or do you have any comment on that? Well, that gave me a bit of an opening. I answered it tactfully, but forcefully, to further implant questioning in their minds. But other than that, I never mentioned it in my classroom.
Yeah, well, you have to worry in classrooms more and more today that these are Jewish students who are setting you
yes.
up to see what you'll
oh,
say,
yes.
and then they're going to take it to the administration.
That's right, and get
complaint.
Your job.
Yeah, they're going to have all those big Jewish organizations behind them. But anyway, when you were doing it, you luckily, at least, you know, you didn't have that problem for a while.
Yes, right. Eventually I did. But that's just mm-hmm. that's another story.
Right. Well, I don't have too many timelines tonight. Very little. For a while there was
okay.
a whole bunch. Now there's not much. So we don't have any for our opening segment here.
Okay.
You can go right ahead and start.
All right. 6th of July, 1942 at dinner. Relations with the foreign press. Miserly outlook of our press chief. The Nuremberg Rally, 4,000 special trains.
You know, I thought just rather than break in, I'll just say
yeah.
here that because it's the foreign, they're going to be talking about this Hanfstangl, who was Hitler's foreign press chief until
right.
at some point he wasn't anymore, but at this point, guess he still was, unless he
yeah.
already wasn't, but I wanted to mention about him a little background that his father, he was born in Germany. His father was a wealthy German. His mother was an American. He went to the U.S. at some time later on, you know, he's a student, and he attended Harvard. And his father was a wealthy man and had important connections. And he, at Harvard, he was acquainted with Walter Lippmann and John Reed,
wow.
Reed the Red, you know. And
yes.
and he had all kinds of contacts with the Roosevelt type people and administration and so on.
Uh-huh.
And played the piano there at the something where they attended, and he was a very good pianist. And at the outbreak of World War I, he asked to be smuggled back into Germany, but they refused it. I mean, the Americans refused it, or the German embassy refused it. They couldn't figure that out. But he did return to Germany in 1922, and that's when he. Met Hitler, and he was very impressed, and he became a National Socialist, and he was very, very devoted to it and worked hard at it, but something happened, and I can't really think right now what it was, and I don't really want to go into it anyway, but there was a falling out. But anyway, they're going to be talking about him.
Yes.
A trait that he has, it's not very likable. It's kind of strange.
He's very
you know,
miserly.
Yeah, it seems like something he just couldn't help. Something that must have gotten into his personality because he came from,
right.
he was wealthy, you know.
Sure.
So there you go. So I just thought I'd stick that in now so I don't have to interrupt
okay.
you.
Good. Glad you did. The Fuhrer says, when I visited Berlin before we came into power, I used to stay at the Kaiserhof. And as I was always accompanied by a complete general staff, I generally had to book a whole floor. And our bill for food and lodging usually came to about 10,000 marks a week. I earned enough to defray these costs, mostly by means of interviews and articles for the foreign press. Towards the end of the struggle period, I was being paid as much as $2,000 or $3,000 a time for such work. In placing these articles and arranging interviews, I often had rows with my foreign press chief, Hanfstangl, because as a businessman rather than a politician, he judged everything in terms of cash received. Once, for example, when I told him to get a certain article published in the whole world press just as quickly as it could possibly be done, he lost a lot of valuable time haggling over the best terms obtainable. On one occasion, he came back at me three times in an attempt to gain my consent to the sale of an article to some news agency, finally hoping to persuade me by dangling an offer of £1,000 sterling before my eyes. When I turned on him in fury and shouted, get the hell out of this, you and your damned greed. Can't you understand that if I want a certain article to appear at a certain time throughout the world, money just doesn't matter? He simply shook his head, wonderingly, unable to understand how I could possibly let a cool thousand slip through my fingers in this way. His rapacity and avarice frequently made Hanfstengel impossible to deal with. On one occasion, in some small peasant's tavern, he made the whole company look ridiculous by raising a frightful row over the bill for a supper, which, mark you, he wasn't being called upon to pay for personally, and on which, in any case, there had been an overcharge of only 3 pence. He was a mighty consumer of vegetables, but he never ordered any for himself. Instead, and this is typical of the man, he kept a sharp eye on the rest of the company and then would go around the table, gathering up the odds and ends left by the others and muttering in justification, "Vegetables are the most health-giving food in the world." In the evenings, in the same way, remarking that cheese was so nourishing, he would go around scrounging bits of cheese from the whole company. Rather eccentric fellow, no doubt. On one occasion, when we had to undertake a journey in a great hurry, I told Hanfstengel to get something to eat for everybody before we left. Although he knew full well that most of us disliked cheese, he came back with 2 baskets full of cheese sandwiches, and then with the greatest aplomb and satisfaction, he carted the not inconsiderable remnants off to his own house. So, you know, you're starting talking about him. There you go. That's the man. Reichsleiter Bormann and General Bodenschatz then told anecdotes about Hanfstengel and his miserly avarice, which confirmed the description the Führer had painted of him.
Everybody joined in with their own story.
I'm sure. Okay, Hitler says, in the course of our many electoral tours, my companions and I have got to know and to love the Reich from Berlin to its uttermost corners. As for the most part, I was invited to take my meals in famille. I also got to know intimately Germans all over Germany. There I used to meet whole families in which the father would be working in our political section, the mother was a member of the Women's Association, one brother was in the SS, the other in the Hitler Youth, and the daughter was in the German Girls League. And so, when we all meet once a year at the party rally at Nuremberg, it always gives me the impression of being just one huge family gathering. The party rally has, however, been not only quite unique, occasion in the life of the NSDAP, but also, in many respects, a valuable preparation for war. Each rally requires the organization of no fewer than 4,000 special trains. As these trains stretched as far as Munich and Halle, H-A-L-L-E, the railway authorities were given first-class practice in the military problem of handling mass troop transportation. Nor will the rally lose its significance in the future. Indeed, I have given orders that the venue of the rally is to be enlarged to accommodate a minimum of 2 million for the future as compared to the 1 million to 1.5 million today. The German stadium, which has been constructed in Nuremberg and of which Horth has drawn 2 magnificent pictures, accommodates 400,000 people and is on a scale which has no comparison anywhere on earth. And that little section right there's a lot there to be proud of. And then there's one thing, Carol, I want to ask your take on this. In the very first paragraph, Hitler says, talking about booking the whole staff, and he says the bill for our food and lodging usually came to about 10,000 marks a week. And then he says, toward the end of the struggle period, I was being paid as much as $2,000 or $3,000 a time for such work. Changing from marks to dollars,
yeah.
That's unique because, I'm thinking, okay, what we need is a breakdown here is how many marks equal to a dollar. And he's saying that what he earned giving these interviews and stories to the foreign press, he's obviously being paid in American dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And how did that – and he said it covered the cost of the staff's stay and, leasing a whole floor for their bill for food and lodging, and he was able to take care of it. But it was mentioned in marks, 10,000 marks a week, and then he was paid $2,000 or $3,000 a time for his work, and he said it took care of the bills. But I just thought it was unique that he used the marks in one sentence and the dollars in another.
Well, because like you said, he was being paid in dollars. And, at that time, the mark was probably still pretty weak because when he says when we came into power, the mark was still pretty weak because it had come up from, being absolute toilet paper. The mark was probably, I don't know how many marks to a dollar, but probably quite a lot of them.
And it was certainly to cover their bill, which was the
Yeah, well, what I thought was so interesting was that he was being paid so much money. And it's not surprising because he's a world leader. I mean, he had even become chancellor by then, or maybe even before he was paid for interviews. He did interviews, and I just figured he did them for free. But now I've got this idea that his press secretary, that they had to pay him something. And as time went on, they had to pay more and more. So this was, smart. And this is another way that they financed their party. They didn't need to have the Jews doing it. They had a lot of ways of doing it.
That's right.
Smart guy.
And the other most impressive part of that little section there was the talk about Nuremberg and the rallies and the 4,000 trains. And just imagine that, 4,000 trains, a million and a half people. And the old films that I have of that period that came out of the Reich, I get inspired watching the Nuremberg rallies. All those people in unison with the flags and the marching and things like that. It is so inspirational to me, and I was very happy to see it mentioned here.
Well, I think for people who like National Socialism like it a lot, that's part of what they like. I mean, it really inspires all of us to see. And just if you're a member of the white race and you're concerned about the what's happening to the white race, to see all those white people out there all in unison and in order and all supporting something, it's just wonderful to see it. Well, now we try to find a few people to come out and do something, but then the government, they had the government, and the government was for it, so look at what you can do. But I would like to say about that the rally, I was looking at a picture of the very first rally. There is a kind of well-known photograph of Hitler and some other people standing around with their flags and stuff. Says it's the first Nuremberg rally. And I just thought, this was quite a big undertaking for them at the time, which was in the early 20s. Oh, when did it start? But it was sometime in the 20s, maybe 25 or something.
Right,
And to decide to do this, to decide to do it, it was a lot of work. It was Hitler's idea, I'm sure. And look what it grew into. It grew into, like you say, one of the most inspiring spectacles that we can look at. And that wonderful film by Riefenstahl. So these wonderful things that came of it. And it takes, if you have the courage to go ahead with an idea that you have, like Hitler did, that's when you can make things happen. That's when you can change the world, really.
Well, true. And attending the ceremony at Nuremberg was for Germans a pilgrimage. It was like a Muslim would go to Mecca. I mean, it was that important to them.
Well, it was for party members, It wasn't for everybody. I don't know if Germans who weren't in the party went, because it was supposed to be for the party. And then, certain military contingents were invited to march and show off their thing, and laborers were invited, or the people in the labor movement. They might not have all been party members. And then the Hitler Youth, they weren't party members because they were just too young. So,
one of the most beneficial things was how it frightened the enemy. It had to have stuck in their craw to see that much, that many Germans participating and forming the swastika and the parade and all that. That had to put a little worry in their hearts.
Right. And so, of course, now, even by many of our own people, they look at some of the rallies and they feel negative about it. The same way as the enemies, by saying, "Well, these people are all being coerced, and look at how they're all behaving
like they
don't have a mind of their own, you know, and they're just going along with everything." But as people that I know who lived during that time, they say that people were so inspired by it, and everyone was so idealistic. It was not anything about evil or bad things. It was all about idealism for Germany then for Europe.
And you know, it's just the reason for all of this negativity is the teaching of false history.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll move on to the 7th of July, 1942, midday. Our dreamy archaeologists. Deforestation is the precursor of decadence, the antiquity of our towns. People make a tremendous fuss about the excavations carried out in districts inhabited by our forebears of the pre-Christian era. I'm afraid I cannot share their enthusiasm, for I cannot help remembering that while our ancestors were making these vessels of stone and clay over which our archaeologists rave, the Greeks had already built an Acropolis. One must be cautious also with any detailed assertions as regards the standard of culture attained by our ancestors during the first Christian millennium. If, for example, some most ancient school primer is discovered in East Prussia, one must not immediately leap to the conclusion that it originated there. In all probability, it had come from the South in exchange for a piece of amber. The real protagonists of culture, both in the 1,000 years before Christ and in the 1,000 years after him, were the peoples of the Mediterranean. This may appear improbable to us today because we're apt to judge these people from present-day appearances, but that's a great mistake. North Africa was once a heavily wooded territory, and Greece, Italy, and Spain, too, at the time of the Greco-Roman era, also had many vast forests. In passing judgment on Egyptian history, too, let me advise caution. Like Greece and Italy, Egypt also, during the period of her glory, was a most habitable country with the most equable climate. So when a people begin to cut down their trees without making any provision for reforestation, and thus rob nature's wise irrigation system of its most essential prerequisite, you may be sure that it's a sign of the beginning of their cultural degeneration. The many false ideas prevalent among our people as regards the cultural development of our ancestors have been encouraged to no small degree by false premises about the age of our cities. I was myself quite taken aback, for instance, when I found that Nuremberg itself was but 7 centuries old. Nuremberg's reputed antiquity is attributable in some measure to the slyness of the Nurembergers themselves. The Oberbürgermeister Liebel, as he himself confessed to me, allowed the 700th anniversary to pass unheralded because he did not wish the attention of the people, who believed the city to be much older, drawn to the truth of the matter. It has, however, been reasonably firmly established that the origin of Nuremberg was an old Salic castle, round which, little by little, a village grew. Most medieval cities were founded in the same way, hence the large number of towns created during the Middle Ages in eastern Germany. These fortress castles were of great importance for the protection of the peasantry. Without them, the country folk would never have been able to maintain themselves against the Oriental hordes, which even at that time ceaselessly pressed against our frontiers and sometimes even overran our territories. In Transylvania, where these fortresses were not so numerous, fortifications had to be constructed against, among others, the Turks, and this explains why one frequently finds that even the churches are designed to resist attack.
Yeah, and now we invite them in when they had to work so hard to keep them out.
Yes. Good point.
Well, I found that interesting. You don't have anything to say about that one?
No, I knew about the Middle Ages and the assault of the Oriental hordes and how Europe was quite vulnerable. And if they didn't have that castle or the moats and the defense, they were cooked goose. So, I knew that happened.
Hitler always, and throughout Table Talk, he's talked about it before, but different ways, is not a believer of the great culture of the far north of that is our homeland, which is kind of like, not necessarily what Himmler was proposing, but was just one of the propositions that they were investigating, and open to, and that all this great culture was in the north. And Hitler has said, and I've read in even other books where he's gone into it in some detail, that it was too cold and that civilization doesn't develop in that kind of weather, and that it was just pretty primitive. And all they found are these bowls, and he kind of puts down some of this stuff, clay vessels. And they did have some beautiful work of medallion-type things, or I don't know what they would have been. I can't think now what they've been used for. I don't know if it was jewelry or just symbols or what have you. There was that, but a lot of it was pretty primitive stuff. And he says that the civilization comes from Greece and Rome. That's where it comes from, European civilization. It doesn't come from up there. But there are a whole lot of people, and particularly these pro-pagans who idealize the warriors up in the forests of the north and, all that they did and so on, that those are our true ancestors. And Hitler doesn't go along with that. Well, he knows they're our ancestors. He knows they're our ancestors.
Sure.
But
sure.
He says that they weren't that advanced, and they had to learn all about civilization from Greece and Rome and the area down there.
See, Hitler is considering the cultural aspects, and I think most folks who lavish attention on it and admiration on the Vikings or other Teutonic tribes are strictly wrapped up in the military prowess, the warrior. They fought the Huns and things like this. But Hitler's taken a view about, hey, what about the making of culture? What about the transfer of knowledge and things like this? And that's why he falls back to the Greco-Roman period.
I thought it was interesting, too, when he's talking about all the forestation when the people started cutting down all the trees. And he says, you may be sure that it is a sign of the beginning of their cultural degeneration when they begin to cut down their trees. And I was wondering if he thinks the cutting down of the trees came first or the racial degeneration came first. He doesn't say, they become racially degenerated and then start cutting down their trees because they didn't have the intelligence or the brains that they had? Or did they, I think that would have to be but you wouldn't notice it so much at first, see? But he's saying, this is what I'm taking it. He's saying that when racial degeneration starts, then when you start seeing the cutting down of the trees, you know it's there. It's happened. Yeah.
And how many people, would ever think of North Africa as a forested region? I mean, here I'm thinking West Texas. I'm thinking the deserts of Tunisia and Libya and whatever. And he's talking about these wonderful forested areas and how nature's balance was destroyed when people just cut down those trees, and it started a degenerate period, and it made a lot of sense.
Yeah, I like where he says when you do that, you rob nature's wise irrigation system of its most essential prerequisite. So, nature knows what it's doing, and we've just changed whole areas.
Things totally out of balance.
Right. I guess man created those deserts and in the Middle East and North Africa and so on. Yeah.
Very true.
Oh, well. Okay. So we go on, and here comes up the part about Spain you liked.
Yes. Yes, interesting. 7th of July, 1942, at dinner. The changing Spanish scene. Serrano Sr. and the church. Where Franco's policy differs from National Socialism or Fascism. Spanish Reds are not Russia's vassals. A nincompoop, not a hero. The intervention of heaven in war and of the skies. A different thing. The first phalange. General Munoz Grande, a fine soldier. Anti-social elements, female communists. General Yodel told the Fuhrer of an incident which had occurred at the Spanish frontier on the occasion of the return home of some wounded of the Blue Division. Now, before I go on here, just a reminder, the Blue Division were the Spaniards who were fighting with the SS, primarily on the Eastern Front. Anyway, these men were refused places in the South Express. And when they tried to get into the guard's van, a company of infantry intervened on the orders of the military governor and ejected them. Marshal Keitel suggested that the Blue Division was in bad odor because of its name, the color blue being a reminder of the old original phalange, which was not a disciple of the church. In the new phalange, admission could be obtained only with the approval of the local priest. The Fuhrer said, "The Spanish situation is developing in a deplorable fashion. Franco, obviously, has not the personality to face up to the political problems of the country. Even so, he started off from a much more favorable position than either the Duce or myself, for we both had not only to capture the state, but also to win over the armed forces to our side. Franco, on the other hand, had both political power and military force in his own hands. It is obvious that he is incapable of freeing himself from the influence of Serrano Sr., in spite of the fact that the latter is the personification of the parson in politics and is blatantly playing a dishonest game with the Axis powers. In point of fact, these parsons are too stupid for words. They are trying, through Serrano Sr., to give a reactionary impulse to Spanish politics and to restore the monarchy. All they will succeed in doing, however, is to cause another civil war, which they themselves will certainly never survive." General Yodel suggested that the British pound might well be behind it all, and that the British hoped in this way to create a second front. The Fuhrer continued, "One must be careful not to put the Franco regime on the same level as National Socialism or Fascism. Tote, who employs many so-styled red Spaniards in his workshops, tells me repeatedly that these Reds are not red in our sense of the word. They regard themselves as revolutionaries in their own right, and industrious and skilled workers have greatly distinguished themselves. The best thing we can do is to hold as many of these people as we can, commencing with the 40,000 already in our camps, and keep them as reserves in case a second civil war should break out. Together with the survivors of the old phalange, they will constitute the most trustworthy force at our disposal." Ambassador Huell then said that he had seen soldiers without arms or badges of rank working under the armed guard in the streets of Madrid. He presumed that they were old soldiers of the Red Army and thought that if they must be employed in this fashion, they should at least be given different clothing. Marshal Keitel said that in passing judgment on the Spanish army, German criteria were of no value. "When the Fuhrer met Franco," he continued, "the Spanish guard of honor was deplorable, and their rifles were so rusty that they must have been quite unserviceable. When the meeting was being arranged, Admiral Canaris warned me that the Fuhrer would be disillusioned to meet in Franco, not a hero, but a little pipsqueak." The Fuhrer continued, "Franco and company can consider themselves very lucky to have received the help of fascist Italy and National Socialist Germany in their first civil war. For as the Red Spaniards never cease explaining, they had not entered into cooperation with the Soviets on ideological grounds, but had rather been forced into it, and thence dragged into a political current not of their own choosing, simply through lack of other support. One thing is quite certain. People speak of an intervention from heaven which decided the Civil War in favor of Franco. Perhaps so, but it was not an intervention on the part of the madam styled the Mother of God, who has recently been honored with a field marshal's baton, but the intervention of the German General von Richthofen and the bombs his squadrons rained from the heavens that decided the issue. Ambassador Huell said the upper classes in Spain were both bone idle and quite impervious to adverse criticism. Hitler continued, "Well, thank goodness the discipline of both the Reds and the Falangists working in the Todt organization is first class, and the more of them we can recruit, the better. But the finding of people capable of clearing up the Spanish political situation will be much more difficult. The problems are more of an internal political than of a military nature. And the foremost of them, the food crisis, is, in view of the proverbial idleness of the population, about the thorniest of the lot. Whether a general possesses the political acumen necessary to success, the future alone will show. But in any case, we must promote as much as we can the popularity of General Muñoz Grande, who is a man of energy, and as such, the most likely one to master the situation. I'm very pleased indeed that the intrigues of the Serrano Sr. clique to get this general dismissed from the command of the Blue Division were frustrated at the last moment. For the Blue Division may well once more play a decisive role when the hour for the overthrow of this parson-ridden regime strikes. In a report on the disorders in Serbia, it was stated that over 95% of the insurgents taken prisoner were ex-criminals. The Führer said, "I'm not the least surprised to hear it, for it only confirms my own ideas about revolutionaries based on the experience of 1918 and 19. If you wish to prevent a revolution by anticipation, the first thing you must do, as soon as the situation becomes critical, is to kill off the whole antisocial rabble. And you can do this only if you've already gathered them safely together in a concentration camp. The theory that by thus putting them in prison you deprive this antisocial rabble of the benefits of the influence of family life is pure claptrap. If you allow them the blessings of family life, all you're doing is to build the foundation cells for a further brood of criminals. Children who grow up in the company of subversive-minded parents themselves become rogues, for their mothers are invariably of the same pernicious ilk as their rogue fathers. Our period of struggle gave me valuable experience of this. At the SS rallies, it was the females of the communist species who were the most despicable. These hags would pelt our men with everything they could lay their hands on, and when our men started to defend themselves, they would hold up their own children, regardless of the danger, as shields to protect themselves. What better proof than that can you have of their complete disregard for the safety and welfare of their children, in which they show themselves to be the complete antithesis of the normal parent and faithful adherents to their own criminal antisocial instincts?" Right, yeah. You know, when I read this part of the Spanish, the part about Spain here and the Reds in Spain, I couldn't help but think back on reading many, many years ago Hemingway's For Whom the Bell Tolls and the movie that was made from that book. And I still distinctly remember how the female communists were portrayed in such a very positive manner in that book and in the movie. And so when he says that these female communists were the most despicable, and that's how and how they were portrayed in the movie as being heroic figures.
That's what they all do. All the movies are for the are communistic in that sense.
That's
so they're always for they were all old back then. If you weren't if you weren't for the Republicans, like Hemingway was, you know, you shouldn't even show your face. Of course, I believed that then, you know, so what did I know? But that Spanish thing was, everything is backwards about it, and we still believe all that stuff today. But this is, I just found what he has to say here really interesting. And by the way, this Serrano Sr. is the brother-in-law of Franco. You find, same with, in Italy with Mussolini, a lot of relatives around. Maybe not a lot, but, you know, a few. And so he obviously married, I guess, Franco's sister or something. But he was, I read about him on his Wikipedia page, and he sounded like a pretty good guy. I guess he just couldn't, he was too connected to the church for Hitler's taste, but he was friendly to Germany, and he was friendly to National Socialism all along, and more so than Franco. And he tried to convince Franco during and after the time that Hitler was there trying to get him to join the war on the Axis side, and he and Sr. Was advocating for that with Franco, but Franco decided not to do it. We don't know how it would have worked out if he had done it anyway, so... but, you know, I guess they all were, all those anti-communists there, they all wanted to restore the monarchy. You know, they are all monarchists, kind of, and or church, you know, the church and the monarchy and so on. Even if you didn't have the monarchy, you had the church was the leading power for that side. And, you know, Hitler couldn't go along with that anymore. So he would like to. He would have liked to seen something different going on there. But these, but these red, call them the Red Spaniards. They were. He said they weren't really connected with Russian communism, Soviet communism, and they didn't want to be. But they got thrown into that because they didn't have anybody else supporting them. And Hitler kind of thought pretty well of them because they were hardworking people. He always liked the industrious, skilled people.
Know. Right, and Carolyn, what that meant to me was, you know, in the National Socialist Revolution in the early stages, Hitler always talked about how many communists converted over to National Socialism, how many of those working men that he won over, and I think he viewed these Spanish communists in the same way, the red, that they were actually good people, but they just, you know, had been misdirected, and he felt like they could become positive and favorable sources for Germany. So he saw them, I think, like he did German communists.
Well, yeah, he was always looking at people as to how they behaved and so on, and what kind of what they were made of, you know, what their character was. And I thought it was quite funny. You remember, it was a couple of weeks ago that he was talking about Spain and saying that he didn't like this development where they were giving military titles, what do you call it, military rank titles to saints and so on. And they actually did that, you know, and gave credit to this particular saint or that one for winning this or winning that. And now here he says that the Mother of God has been honored with the Field Marshal's baton. That's really amazing. But that helps, I guess that helps the people to get into the mood of the whole thing. There you go, that's how powerful the church was. And it was what stood up to the communism there. And so that's what, that's kind of the, what you had there. You had communism or you had Catholicism facing off on one another. That wasn't too happy a situation as far as Hitler was concerned. But he praises this Munoz Grande. And on the little picture show that I have on Blog Talk for this program, there's two pictures with of Munoz Grande. One just one. He's getting a medal from a German commander, and he was fighting there. He was leading the Blue Division on the Eastern Front, and he likes him because there he, again, he's an energetic person. He hates lazy people. Boy, Hitler just really always brings up when people are idle, the idlers, the shiftless, the lazy.
Yes,
that's what he doesn't like.
That's right.
And this and the other picture I had was with Franco and Sr. standing with some other people. But this Munoz Grande seemed like a, you know, obviously was a very good guy. And then my other comment is about Serbia. Now, you said 95% of the insurgents taken prisoner were ex-criminals. My internet copy says 35%, but I guess that's an error because the book would be right.
That's what it says here. It was stated that over 95%.
Yeah. It sounds like a lot, but it actually is talking about the insurgents. It's not just talking about all the people or something or all the troops or whatever, but the insurgents who were trying to topple the government. And there's, you know, I just don't have a good impression of Serbia. Maybe I shouldn't say things like that about particular countries you know, they're so in the spirit of revolutionaries all the time, but maybe they've calmed down a little bit by now.
Yeah.
Who knows? I don't know. But they're always on the communist side. There are always a lot of communists there. Even today, they remember the Soviet days quite fondly. So, and yeah, these females who are very committed and really gotten political, you know, total political animals. They will fight like tigers, and underhanded too. I would do that. I would do any underhanded thing for my belief.
Sure.
If I was on the front lines there. But that doesn't mean you like the enemy who's doing it. And then today I thought, reading that today's, you know, these anti-fascist demonstrations, that's what they're usually called, more than anti-racist, anti-fascist, that get, you know, come out in the streets and make a lot of noise every time some little group of right-wingers wants to do something. The women can be quite terrible. They really get into it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Well, that's all my comments.
This next little section is quite short, in it is mentioned Archangel, and that's a northern port, and the northern part of Russia, like Murmansk, and we're talking far north. I mean, not that far from the North Pole. A very important port, both Murmansk and Archangel, and those ports were naturally frozen in a lot of the year, and that is one of the main reasons why Russia was so intent on getting access to southern ports, and I'm talking like Sevastopol in the Crimea, anywhere Russia could have access to water. They were quite interested in establishing such a location. But this next little paragraph here is about Archangel, which was a far northern port.
Yeah, you know, we had I think though it was in the timeline, but there must have been maybe a mention of it in the text a little while back that this convoy had taken off from. From the Arctic, and how the Germans were having real success in destroying them, but that way. It wasn't last week, was it? It had to have been the week before, it seems like. And now they're just saying this is on July 8th that they're sinking these ships. But we've heard about this before.
Right. Anyway, it's quite, like I say, a brief, but it's important. This 8th of July, 1942, midday. Destruction of a British convoy bound for Archangel. To my great delight, our aircraft and submarines have already succeeded in sinking no less than 32 ships out of a British convoy of 38 on its way to Archangel. Even yesterday, when a bare two-thirds had been sunk, I urged the drawing of a caricature of Roosevelt in Kladderadatsch. Most of the war material in this convoy came from America. And I suggested that Roosevelt should therefore be shown sitting on a high platform and laughingly casting into the sea all the tanks, planes, and other materiel that the American workmen were handing up to him. The caption I suggested was, "We do not fight for gain or gold, but for a better world." Be that as it may, the owners of naval construction yards in America have certainly veritable gold mines in their possession. this was, like I say, a short but pertinent statement. And his talking about, let's make the cartoonist have Roosevelt sitting on a platform just tossing this material into the sea as it's being produced in America and all, and saying, hey, we're not in this for gain or gold. We're trying to make a better world. And what that was showing the total hypocrisy. And what he means here when he says the owners of naval construction yards in America have certainly veritable gold mines in their possession, war profiteers. They could care less about loss of material, thus Roosevelt being pictured tossing these things into the sea, because further production means more money.
All right. And, I didn't pick that up. I figured that he was wasting what they were making, but I see now, but that didn't quite fit. But, yeah, very good, Ray. And then this Kladderadatsch was a humorous magazine in Germany that was pro-National Socialist.
Uh-huh.
And what's interesting, too, is that Hitler took an interest in, he gets into the propaganda sometimes, and he obviously did here. He even went and told them what he'd liked them to do. But I guess maybe they didn't do it because he doesn't say that they did. But
right.
But, yeah, that's a real good point that it's all, you know, Roosevelt's buddies are making more money and more money off this war.
Sure.
And so what the heck? We'll just do
yeah,
more.
Yeah, he's hypocritically while these ships are being sunk, 32 out of 38, and all this loss of American production.
Yeah, and
there
have to be crews are being lost too, right? Probably.
Yes. Oh, yeah, yeah. He just says, his hypocritic stance about we're in this fight not for gold, we're not for gain, but for a better world. And, of course, the guys back home are just grinning from ear to ear because production lines are rolling. It's reminiscent of Vietnam. And the helicopter production that Lyndon Johnson and Lady Bird owned so much of, and all the tremendous loss of helicopters. And they had a huge investment in Bell Helicopter. And so the more helicopters down and had to be replaced, the more money went into the LBJ's pocket. So it's essentially the same thing.
And, you know, most of us don't know there's going to be a war. We hope not. We don't think about investing in things like that. But there are people who do know. And they're in there investing in all of that. And it's never really create the scandal that it should be is never brought out. You know, there's mention of it, but it's not what should be made of it is not made.
Yes.
Anyway, let's go on to the dog.
All right. 8th of July, 1942, at dinner. My dog, a vegetarian. The cat and the mouse. The effects of the meat diet. In many ways, my sheepdog Blondie is a vegetarian. There are lots of herbs which she eats with obvious pleasure, and it is interesting to see how she turns to them if her stomach is out of order. It's astonishing to see how wise animals are and how well they know what's good for them. I once watched how a cat went about eating a mouse. She didn't gobble it all at once, but first of all played with it as if giving it the chance to escape. It was only when the mouse was bathed in sweat with all this running hither and thither that the cat gave it the coup de grace and ate it. Obviously, it is in this state that the mouse appears most succulent and savory to the cat. Keitel said that man also does not normally eat his meat raw, and that the Huns used to put their meat under their saddles to make it tender. Hitler continued, rather on the analogy of letting it stew in its own juice, you mean? Man, too, undergoes considerable change as the result of profuse perspiration engendered by violent physical effort. Whenever I have to make a speech of great importance, I'm always soaking wet at the end, and I find I've lost 4 or 6 pounds in weight. And in Bavaria, where, in addition to my usual mineral water, local custom insists that I drink 2 or 3 bottles of beer, I lose as much as 8 pounds. This loss of weight is not, I think, injurious to health. The only thing that always worried me was the fact that my only uniform was a blue one, and it invariably stained my underclothes. When I later gave up eating meat, I immediately began to perspire much less, and within a fortnight to perspire hardly at all. My thirst, too, decreased considerably, and an occasional sip of water was all I required. Vegetarian diet, therefore, has some obvious advantages. I shall be interested to see whether my dog eventually becomes a complete and confirmed vegetarian. Anyway, that's fascinating. We're well aware of Hitler's preference for vegetarian diet, and I thought that was nice.
Well, yeah, except the problem is, Hitler shared this, vegetables are very alkaline, but beans and things like that are not. So if you have to supplement and get your protein from beans, peas, all of that stuff is acidic. And then if you eat bread and pastries and sugar fruits, so they're very acidic. And a lot of vegetarians will, you know, eat desserts because they're not meat. And so it gets to be something that's not necessarily that well balanced or that good for you. If you design your vegetarian diet right, it would be. But it's the desserts that cause a problem, that people might have more desire for dessert when they're vegetarians than when you're not. That's what I think. And we need a lot of fat, and you don't, vegetarian diets often don't have enough fat in them.
Right.
But I think dogs are, at first I thought, oh no, he's trying to make his poor dog vegetarian. But dogs do well on vegetables, not only vegetables, but it's cats that have to have an all meat diet. It's really cats that don't really like that. But dogs enjoy a lot of vegetables. I always added vegetables to my dog's food.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That's important.
I agree.
You know, a lot of dogs will eat raw carrots, raw carrot pieces and so on.
That's right.
I added.
Okay. Ready to move on to 9th of July, 1942, midday. Ukrainian harvest. Food problem is a problem of transport. The note issued to the press on the subject of the Ukrainian tour of the Minister for Eastern Territories is a bad one. What's the use of warning the population now against false hopes of a higher ration based on the Ukrainian harvest? There are always more pessimists among the people than optimists. And in my opinion, it shows an irresponsible lack of consideration at this juncture to dash the hopes of an easing of the situation, and so to make life for the people harder than it need be. In any case, any declaration on the subject is at present premature. As things are, it is impossible to say whether or not the population of the Reich will derive any material benefit from the Ukrainian harvest. The problem is less one of a good or bad harvest than of transport. If we can solve the transport problem, we can raise the rations. But even if all did depend on the crop itself, and the crop turns out to be a bad one, public announcement of the fact merely increases the justification for pessimism. What we must do is to speed up the measures already in hand to increase production in the appropriate agrarian territories, and by this means find the way out of the impasse. Further, we must at all costs avoid any suggestion that the military units, by accumulating reserves of food and thus decreasing the amount available for home distribution, are in any way responsible or to blame for the current situation. The Liebstandarte, for example, have acted perfectly correctly, in my opinion, in collecting for their own use a herd of 500 pigs and running their own kolkhoz, as is also Field Marshal Klug in accumulating many months of food reserves for his 8th Army. If our troops on the Eastern Front get stuck in the mud and rations cannot be sent up to them, we shall be thankful indeed that they have had the foresight to look after themselves. Now, that's a little short deal there, but what it gives hint of, and more than hint, is now food is becoming a problem.
Yeah, the Germans are not getting enough food. Their rations are cut too much and to give them too little. They're hoping for an increase in their rations, and they're looking forward to Ukraine, thinking, yeah, see, it's July, it's getting time for the harvest. Maybe they'll get more bread anyway or something. The poor Germans really did not have an adequate diet. Got around to 1942. Maybe it was just starting then that food, the food situation was critical. But Hitler's standing up and protecting his troops, you know, his soldiers, as he always does. He knows that they need it, and he's not going to hold them responsible if they're providing for themselves in advance what they can, and thinks it's a good idea, and he's not going to let them be blamed. So. It's always, you know, the people at home have to tighten their belts.
Yeah, bite the bullet, and that's true. And you need support from the home front, so he's got to try to keep things totally in balance as best he can. The 9th of July, 1942, at dinner, events in Egypt, Italian susceptibility, Churchill's praise of Rommel, the future status of Egypt, German colonists in the Eastern Territories, the role of Italian colonists, road construction before all else. When we occupy Alexandria or Cairo, the Foreign Office need not even suggest the appointment of a resident for Egypt. In Rommel, we have a commander-in-chief who has covered himself with imperishable renown and who must be regarded as one of the outstanding figures of the war. And for the Foreign Office to presume to meddle in his affairs is a palpable absurdity. I am, moreover, of the opinion that Egypt belongs properly to the Italian sphere of influence. For us, the Egyptian Sphinx has no particular attraction, but for the Italian Imperium, it is of vital importance. The appointment of a resident might well create an annoying precedent and would justify the Italians in sending a representative to, say, the Caucasus, a region in which we alone are vitally interested. It will suffice if a suitable person is accredited to the Italian resident in Egypt as the representative of Rommel, as operational commander-in-chief. People frequently ask, how is it that Rommel enjoys so great a worldwide reputation? Not a little is due to Churchill's speeches in the House of Commons, in which, for tactical reasons of policy, the British Prime Minister always portrays Rommel as a military genius. Churchill's reason for doing so, of course, is that he does not wish to admit that the British are getting a damn good hiding from the Italians in Egypt and Libya. He may also hope that by emphasizing the super excellence of Rommel, he may sow seeds of discord between the Italians and ourselves. The Duce, however, is far too clever to be taken in by a trick of that sort. Indeed, he has himself frequently sung Rommel's praises throughout the world. Between them, Churchill and the Duce have caused the name of Rommel to be hallowed among the primitive races of North Africa and the Middle East with a prestige which is impossible to exaggerate. This shows how dangerous it is for a responsible person to portray his opponent in the manner in which Churchill has portrayed Rommel. The mere name suddenly begins to acquire a value equal to that of several divisions. Imagine what would happen if we went on lauding Timoshenko to the skies. In the end, our own soldiers would come to regard him as a superman. And when one is dealing with semi-primitive peoples, these considerations carry even more weight. The remark of our General Crewell when he was captured by the English ran like lightning through the whole Islamic world as far as Ankara. When asked how he liked Shepherd's Luxury Hotel in Cairo, he replied, it will make a grand headquarters for Rommel. As regards the future status of Egypt, it is clear that Italy must retain a vital interest therein. Their possessions in Eritrea and Abyssinia alone render it essential that they should receive the Suez Canal, and they can guarantee the security of the Suez Canal only by maintaining garrisons in Egypt. If the Italians wish to establish themselves firmly in Egypt, both politically and militarily, they must guard against the danger of evoking among the local populations any feeling of inferiority. In this, they would do well to learn a lesson from the British, who, with centuries of colonial experience behind them, have learned the art of being masters and of holding the reins so lightly, withal, that the natives do not notice the curb. The Italians must also guard against too eager an adaptation of all the local habits. Here, Rommel gives them a good example. Throughout the campaign, Rommel has never once gone ambling around on a camel, for he knows that he can't ride a camel as well as the natives in the first place, and that secondly, by invariably moving at speed in an armored vehicle, he has always made a tremendous impression on them. As far as we're concerned, we too must avoid over-enthusiasm in our eastern territories. We must not try too ardently to impose our own German ideas of personal cleanliness on the local inhabitants and attack them daily with curry comb and polish. It really does not matter to us whether they wash and sweep their houses daily. We're not their overseers, and all we're there for is to promote our own interests. The life of the German colonists must therefore be kept as far separate from that of the local inhabitants as is possible. In the pubs in which the natives spit all over the shop, no German must be allowed to enter. The Germans must have their own pubs from which the natives will be excluded. Then the locals can spit away to their heart's content. By leaving the local inhabitants to their own devices and by not interfering with their local customs, we create the most favorable atmosphere for the creation of purely and exclusively German settlements, and the easiest way of preventing any fusion between the German and the native population is to encourage the latter to adhere to their own ways and to discourage them from aping ours. To return to Egypt, I hope that the Italians, who so far have shown considerable skill in their relations with the Muslims, will not tarnish the reputation they have deservedly gained. They should avoid getting involved in matters of minor detail. In the things that matter, irrigation, road construction, and the like, I'm quite sure that the Italian colonists, who work like bees, will achieve marvels under the leadership of the Duce. If they had but been given 10 years in Ethiopia, the Italian road constructors would have turned it into a model colony. In Egypt, the Italians will have a much easier task, for except for lack of coal and iron, the country is completely self-supporting. I cannot repeat too often that, as in Egypt, so in our eastern territories, road construction is one of the most important tasks. As road maintenance is practically impossible during the winter, the new roads must be so sited and constructed as not to expose them to the dangers of snowdrifts. They must be constructed, for the most part, on embankments, which the winds of winter will sweep free of any undue accumulation of snow, and the foundations of the embankment must be particularly solidly constructed, bearing in mind the powerfully disintegrating forces of the thaw period. Where it's available, granite must be used, otherwise the stone which abounds in all riverbeds.
Well, wow, that was really interesting.
Yeah, the talk about Rommel and the reputation he's built up and all, and deservedly so, and the Fuhrer realizes what a powerful tool he is for Germany.
Well, it's just a fact that he's become such a hero in everybody's eyes, and they're seeing him almost as, you know, irresistible. You know, what happened is, as soon as he reached this high level of so much success, then he started not having success. But it wasn't the next stage was it was a lack of armament. It wasn't his fault that he went so fast.
Right.
Isn't that what we were talking about before? You mentioned that before, that he moved forward so fast that he and this is what often happens. I think you've talked about this, that when what goal to reach and they go the whole company moves so fast. Their supplies don't keep up.
Your supply lines can't keep up.
Yeah, and not just and including armaments and so on, and then you're stuck, and then you're stopped. So,
it's and then kind of out on a limb too.
And then the other side kind of regroups, and they're not so easy to you know you're on sort of a row there, and the other side just keeps falling back and falling back. But then when it stops, then they get a chance to get themselves straightened out again. And I think, I don't know that he ever had so much success after this. I don't know. We'll find out. But it's interesting
that he
always says again that Churchill is emphasizing what a genius Rommel is in order not to show that the British are not doing a very good job, maybe. Well, you know, if they didn't have to be up against Rommel, they would be doing better.
Right. And how much it was helping the German forces that Rommel was being so praised by Churchill, because, you know, when they hear, uh-oh, we're going up against Rommel's forces, already they're intimidated. And Hitler makes a very good point of, imagine what would happen if we went on lauding Timoshenko, who is, of course, a pretty doggone good Russian military general commander. And you know, and if Germany would say, oh, this Timoshenko, he's unstoppable, he's a professional of the first degree, and it's intimidating to your own forces.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's glad, of course, that the Allied forces are so in awe of Rommel. It's a very positive thing.
How do you spell that General Crewell's name? How is that spelled, Ray? Oh, it's where they're talking about Timoshenko.
Oh, okay. Yeah. It's spelled in my book Cruwell with double dots over the U.
Oh, that's what I had. Okay. That's funny. I've never seen such a name like that. Cruel.
Uh-huh.
I don't even know how you'd pronounce that. Anyway,
right.
So then I think he's... I found this business about Italy and Egypt, saying that Italy should receive Egypt and the Suez Canal. He wants to think well of Italy. He wants to think that Germany and Italy can, you know, combine, do a lot of the running of Europe. And even though he's talking about the Germanic League, which doesn't include Italy, but he wants to give a lot of praise to Italy. But you can see at the same time, he's a little concerned that they won't handle it right, you know, that they'll get carried away and maybe they'll show off too much or maybe they won't treat the inhabitants right. And all of that's very important. Of course, he's going to make those rules for his own German troops very strongly, and he wants the Italians to do the same for what they take over. So I thought that was kind of interesting. Plus, I think he's done a better job here of explaining why he says that how the German attitude toward the local inhabitants in the eastern territories, meaning, you know, again, the Slavic peoples there, then I think he's made a better case of it today in this section as to why. Because before, when he talked about it, it had kind of a sound of that they were so inferior, and we're not going to associate with them. You know, we're going to be so much better, you know, on a higher level. We're going to have our own towns, our own communities, everything of our own, and just we're not going to try to bring them up, just leave them to their own devices if they, you know, the way they've always been.
Yeah,
and it sounded very bad to a lot of people. But here he's explaining it better, and this has been his idea all along, I'm sure, that we're not going to try to remake them or change them, or it would only irritate them. Let them, you know, live the way they've lived. If they want to,
exactly.
If they want to copy Germans or learn things from Germany, if they want to, they're certainly free to do so. But we're not going to say, well, you have to be like us, or we, you know, what you have is not good enough, and you're not good enough. He's
right.
not doing that at all. So,
right.
you know, but these are kind of sensitive subjects here.
Yeah. And I'm glad you pointed that out because his words here are much more moderated from the past, what we've been reading there. And it's pragmatic that he be that way. You know, hey, we don't care about how often they take a bath or how often they clean their house or whatever. Leave them alone. And things are going to be better off that way. Good point.
Yeah, but he made it clear that some of their behavior is a lot more crude than ours, and we're not going we're just not going to involve ourselves in that. Let them do it if they spit in their taverns. That's the way they do on the floor. Well, that's their place, and we'll have our own places where we don't do it.
Sure.
Right. So, well, okay. Is there anything more you want to comment on this before we say good night?
Well, once again, I really enjoyed the show tonight. I think it was informative, and I think we picked apart a lot of things here and saw different perspectives. So, rocking right along, and glad folks joined us, and hope they'll come back next week, and we'll have another very good show.
And so this has been Hitler's Table Talk, and the date is January 29, 2015. This has been me, Carolyn Yeager, and I'll just speak for Ray and Ray Goodwin, bringing this to you, and we'll see you again next week. Good night.